Good evening and welcome behind the news for December 9, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. It's been quite a while since I've been here. See if I remember how to do this. Got two guests up tonight. First, about 10 minutes from now, we'll be speaking with Bertha Lewis, who is the co-chair of the Working Families Party. And the Working Families Party, key to two rather impressive political victories, the increase in the New York State minimum wage and a reduction, not as nice, as deep as we'd like, but it's still a reduction in the drug sentences under the Rockefeller drug laws. We'll talk to Bertha Lewis about what the Working Families Party did, what they're up to, what their plan is for the future. And also just to thank her and congratulate her. I'd been rather skeptical about the Working Families Party in the past, so this is a bit of a mea culpa for me, and a little bit of, reparations for past unjustified criticism, I guess. And then at the bottom of the hour, Jamie Galbraith, an economist at the University of Texas, will be talking about what's going on with the U.S. dollar and the trade deficit and all those sorts of things. He has a piece recently on TomPaine.com, extended look at that if you want to read what Jamie Galbraith has to say, but we'll get the audio version of that in about half an hour. And before we get to Bertha Lewis, a couple of announcements. First of all, reminder, please come down and visit our book fair, the holiday book fair here at the WBAI studios, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. Remember, you do need a picture ID to get in. It always causes me to grumble and curse every time I have to display my driver's license to walk into an office building, but apparently this is going to prevent mass death, I guess. But anyway, you do need that to get in. But we'll be here till 9 p.m. tonight, tomorrow, also 3 to 9 p.m., and then Saturday and Sunday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., books, gifts, videotapes, CDs, cassettes, and even an origami workshop Sunday at 2. So come down to the book fair, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. Be sure to bring a picture ID. And then also another announcement, our friends at the Brecht Forum are having a holiday party this Saturday, December 19th. December 18th. That's starting at 7:30, December 18th. Let me get that date straight. That'll be at the Brecht Forum, where they are at 122 West 27th Street, but not much longer, 122 West 27th Street. They have to move at the end of the month to splendid new facilities at West Beth, but they do need to raise some money to refurbish their new space. So if you're generous, in a generous mood, please do kick into the move campaign. But Brecht Forum Holiday Party, December 18th, Saturday, 7:30, 122 West 27th Street, 10th floor. Also a benefit for the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee. So that's 122 West 27th Street, Saturday the 18th, 7:30 p.m. onward, the Brecht Forum's Holiday Party. Some of the economic headlines last Friday, November Employment Report, the monthly report on the state of the U.S. job market released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The headline gain of 112,000 jobs was actually quite a disappointment, below expectations and well below the 337 or so thousand that we saw the previous month. That was looking like an anomaly, but the job market seems to be growing, but not very rapidly. The jobs that we did gain last month, only in a handful of sectors, not very broadly based, just a few of them accounted for almost all of the gain: construction, computer systems design, temp firms, healthcare, hotels, and food services. These are not, for the most part, the driving forces of economic growth. Also, very weak performance in wages. Average hourly wages up just a tenth of a percent on the month, and it looks like a year-to-year decline in the real wage that is corrected for inflation of over 1%. This is the worst real wage performance we've seen since 1991. So very weak performance on wages. Also, average hours were down, so average weekly wages were down even more as a result of that. So the job market, not what we'd be seeing normally at this stage of an economic expansion, where some 8 or 9 million jobs jobs below, for in fact, where we would be 3 months after, 3 years rather, after an economic recovery began. That's what it says officially. It doesn't really feel like one, and it is the weakest economic recovery slash expansion since the end of World War II, in by many measures. And certainly the weakest job market we've seen, and even some of the other numbers like GDP growth among the weakest. So that despite an extended round of low interest rates and big government deficits, which should have stimulated the economy into a better performance than it's showing. Also, this morning it was reported that the first-time claims for unemployment insurance, people who've lost their jobs and headed over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits, that number was up by 8,000 last week, the second consecutive weekly increase. Also, the number of people continuing to draw claims up by 91,000. So the job market is showing some signs of slowing down. Now, some analysts are viewing this as just a seasonal quirk. The week-to-week numbers do jump around. It's hard to adjust those for seasonal variations, but the 2 weeks of increases are not what we'd like to be seeing right now. Also, some of the leading indexes for the U.S. economy are showing some signs of stability. They're not accelerating, but they are stabilizing. The weekly index compiled by the Economic Cycles Research Institute has been steady now for the last few weeks. Again, not accelerating, but also not declining anymore. The indexes, leading indexes compiled by the OECD, the Paris-based think tank for the rich countries in the world, that also slow, flat, not declining, but it does seem that the global economy is slowing down. And certainly, the Japanese economic recovery, which looked pretty good a few months ago, is looking more and more tepid. Household consumption in the quarter ending in September, far weaker than expected, and exports are weakening, the job market not so great. So it looks like the Japanese economic recovery, which looked like it was the first real one that they'd seen in over a decade, does seem to be sputtering. It's not collapsed yet, but it's sputtering a bit. The weekly ABC News Money Magazine poll of consumer attitudes improved a little bit last week, but took a big dive the week before and is now considerably below what we saw late October, early November. So consumers not looking very optimistic about economic prospects or their own personal finances. We're seeing fairly weak retail sales also in the early part of this holiday season. The day after Thanksgiving, the big so-called Black Friday, the second biggest shopping day of the year. The Saturday before Christmas has now become the biggest shopping day of the year. But that rather disappointing performance for most stores. Walmart having one of its weakest performances in a long, long, long time because it didn't discount enough, apparently. It's being undercut by its rivals. A very strange turn of events for Walmart. But also, people in the lower income brackets really, really stretched. High gasoline prices, weak job market showing up in weak retail spending at the bottom of the income distribution. Also, people in the middle not doing so well. People in the high end prospering nicely, though. That's what the economy is looking like these days. Tiffany thriving, Walmart stumbling. And some news from abroad. That's a little better. Mexican unemployment rate fell by four-tenths of a percentage point to 3.6% in October. That's a deceptively low number. Most people are really not counted as part of the formal job market in Mexico, but we can guess from the direction that job market in Mexico improving somewhat. Also, similar in Brazil. We saw a decline in the Brazilian unemployment rate from 10.9 in September to 10.5 in October. Still quite high, but off the about 3 percentage points lower than it was in April when it was over 13%. So economy is not doing well, not in recession. But we're not seeing the kind of acceleration or broad improvement that we would like to. And the Federal Reserve is still in a tightening mode. And they're worried about inflation. They're worried about the weak dollar. And we'll turn to all those issues when we talk to Jamie Galbraith in about 20 minutes. But this is an anomalous and strange economic constellation of events we're experiencing right now. So, we're now joined by Bertha Lewis, who is the co-chair of the Working Families Party. The Working Families Party played a significant part in two recent political victories, the New York State Legislature's override of the governor's veto of the increase in the state minimum wage. So it'll be at some point a little over $7 an hour, $2 above the national minimum. And they also, New York State Legislature passing a reduction in sentences under the Rockefeller drug laws, in which also the Working Families Party played a crucial part. Welcome to WBAI, Bertha Lewis.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we all the residents of New York State, the Working Families Party, a big thanks for the work you did on these two issues. I think major triumphs, both the benefit it's going to do people, but it's also a nice political victory, nice symbolic victory, nice ideological victory, and you folks have done a lot of good work on this.
Well, it is. It's. I thank you for your congratulations. As you know, people have been calling us, and it's kind of funny because you know, when you're an organizer and you're out there working for social justice, you know, we usually don't win. was a very long fight, and it really does feel good to win.
Let's talk a little bit about both of these things. The minimum wage is a broadly popular thing, so you weren't at least fighting against the tide of popular opinion, although, of course, the Republican Party is not fond of it. A lot of the people in the business class are not very fond of it. But how long have you been working on this issue?
For 6 years, ever since the party first came into being in 1998. From that first day, minimum wage, raising the state's minimum wage, has always been our major campaign, because, you know, we wanted to make sure that the first big campaign that we did was significant to working families. And to have a state of New York at that time only paying $4.25 an hour, and then eventually going up to $5.15 because the federal government raised it, we thought was a disgrace. And so we've been at this for six long years.
So what was your strategy? How did you go about pressing this case?
Well, one of the things is, you know, the campaign, I think, has built, as the party has built, we formed a broad-based coalition. And as you say, everybody understands this. This is popular to the general public. People understand this. But you do have to build up a broad enough and strong enough coalition of folks. You have to have it diverse, and it has to go deep, and it has to be sustained. But you got to do the hard work. We knocked on hundreds of thousands of doors over those 6 years, hundreds of thousands of petition signatures, rallies and meetings and lobby visits and letter writing and all kinds of different actions and campaigns, and from churches to union halls to, you know, street corners. One of the good things that happened this year was to be able to have the Daily News here in New York City take up this mantle. A reporter lived for a month. You know, she said, let me see what it's like to live on $5.15 an hour. And, of course, I think in the end, it's all about politics, right? And it's all about power. And I think the Senate, the new leadership in the Senate, the Democratic leadership under David Patterson, actually moving ahead to challenge the Democratic minority position and to go after taking back Democratic seats, and the threat of what the new leadership of the Democrats in the state Senate would be, all of that sort of came together in a perfect storm for us that I think got that. And I don't think any of it of itself would have happened. The crowning touch was having the Senate Dems work with us, and then all the accumulation of the 6 years of work.
So it was just really old-fashioned organizing, no, no sexy internet techniques or anything like that, right?
We used the internet. Yes, we did. We used, some was sexy, some was ugly, but we were not too proud to use anything and everything.
And did you learn any lessons out of this for a future campaign?
Well, you do learn some. You learn, you know, you always learn lessons when you put together a huge coalition. You always learn lessons about, you know, the capacity. You also learn lessons about who, in fact, is arrayed against your issue. And it was very surprising how the opposition would distort the issue. It was surprising to us.
Well, did they take the usual line? It would destroy jobs. It was going to hurt
those. Destroy jobs. I mean, just outright lies.
Yeah.
You know, this is only for teenagers. Just outright lies. Or, you know, you should just leave it up to the federal government. Also, you know, our allies and workers being intimidated, you know, for participating in grassroots efforts. So you learn how hard it is. You also learn what you can do. If you are focused and you just say, you know what, we don't have to win this year, but we're coming back. And what you do learn is a sustained assault, you know, will in fact win. The people can rule. And you also learn that you have to really be very strategic politically. You need some political force, because having the Working Families Party ballot line, being able to give it, take it away, dangle it, use it as a force for good or a force for punishment, also being able to build up over these past 6 years with other campaigns, with other things. I mean, you know, you talked a little bit about Rockefeller Drug.
And, yeah, we'll get to that in a second.
You know, that helped all of the politicians who were on the Working Families Party line, and even those who were off of the Working Families Party line, all of that played into it. So it was hard. It was dealing with the Republicans was a new experience. But what we realized was that when people come against us and say, you'll never win, that's wrong.
Speaking of Republicans, the Working Families Party has endorsed a few Republicans. And it's,
yes, we have.
Why do you do that?
Well, first of all, we believe that third-party politics is the politics of the working man and woman. For so long, people say they were whining. The Democrats don't pay us any attention. You know, or we get used. And we're saying, you know what? We are looking for policy. We're looking for people who are actually going to deliver to the men and women and families that we represent. I know it seems crazy, but there are some Republicans who are not insane.
It's getting harder to believe with these past
No, well, you've had, there is, you know, you've got some New York Republicans, and you know, with the national Republicans, they may seem to be crazy, but in fact, here in New York, when people would say, we need to wait for the federal government, we're like, they'll never do it. And even President Bush said, I won't raise the federal minimum wage. But, you know, you have to give credit where credit is due. Republicans do have to deliver to their home districts. All politics is local. And so some of them actually do, would be very moderate. They would be considered very radical Republicans were they put up against their national counterparts. So we also, you know, we are there to push forward the deliverance to our folks. And good, bad, or indifferent, we say you need to deal with legislation and public policy. So, that's how we judge you.
So if there's some crucial Republicans that promise to vote with you on certain issues, you'll give them an endorsement.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it works.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, we have a rigorous interview and endorsement process. You know, we actually do have our local chapters and clubs interview folks. 30, 40 people do that. They consider things from every angle. It's not just, we don't have the politics of personality. You know, or let somebody's party affiliation get in the way, because we're going to hold you accountable to what it is that we endorse you on. So you have to have our platform. You must deliver to the local group. The local group who's going to do the work for, you know, on that campaign actually has to believe in there. And we are a coalition of labor and community. And so you want to try to come up with a way that whoever the party endorses actually delivers for both of those constituents.
I'm speaking with Bertha Lewis, who's the co-chair of the Working Families Party in New York State. And let's turn to the other issue, which the popular opinion wasn't quite as unanimously on your side. There's a lot of lock them up and throw away the key feelings throughout the population. So you did get the legislature, you were a crucial part of the work that got the legislature to pass a reduction in the Rockefeller drug laws.
Absolutely.
How'd that happen?
Now, we're not saying that we did this. You know, people have been working on the Rockefeller drug laws for a very long time. But we do believe that we contributed to helping to push, for lack of a better metaphor I'll use, sports, to push the ball down the field. And that was with the stunning victory of David Soares for district attorney in Albany County, the first African American to be elected there. And this is a county that only has 4% of the population who is of color. So that was pretty amazing. And also people said, you can't elect a law and order guy based on reform of Rockefeller drug laws. Well, again, you said it best. You know, the average common man knows that these laws are outdated and silly and stupid. And so, and when you talked to folks and ran a campaign that said this is costing money, this is costing lives, it makes no sense, you need to reform, that would be a message that resonated. And boy, oh boy, everybody was against us. You can't win this, you don't have the numbers. The established Democrats, you're running against an incumbent Democrat? How could you do that? And then what happened was we found that, in fact, that establishment up there ran the most racist, vicious campaign ever.
The Democratic establishment.
That Democratic incumbent.
Yeah.
It was horrible. You know, and had it not been for the Working Families Party early on, getting into that race and helping to raise money for it and helping to win that race and helping to run it and put it together, David Soares would not have been elected. And so on that election, when people were debating up in Albany about the passing the Rockefeller drug law legislations, David Soares winning that DA race, if it wasn't mentioned once, it was mentioned 10 times.
So some legislators got the fear of the Lord in them.
Well, they also got the message that here's a young man, African-American running in a predominantly white county on Rockefeller drug reform, got elected overwhelmingly. And so what politicians do understand is numbers. They do understand people voting. And maybe with all of the debating back and forth and the policy and the advocacy and the papers and studies that have been written, that couldn't convince them. What convinced them was somebody ran politically, they got voted in on that line. And so they said, uh-oh, I think it's time for us to change.
Now, some people are complaining that the reduction wasn't deep enough and that the sentences remain still quite severe.
They're right.
Are you continuing to work on this issue?
Oh, absolutely. I think that they're right. Of course they're right. I mean, you know, it's like getting a little tiny piece of cancer. We're not going away on this, but let's give credit where credit is due. It is a significant step along the road to repeal. And we are going to, and because we're not going away, because we're going to, you know, people are going to show that programs work, that this is not going to unleash the hordes of people pillaging and plundering in our communities, that folks can move together, that some judges can work together with district attorneys, You know, we're going to be back there every year putting another, tearing down another brick in that Rockefeller wall. So this was one step. I think there's about 400 or 500 people in jail today who will be getting out very soon. They think it's very significant because they may be home for Christmas. So to them, this is not insignificant. And there is more work to do. People are absolutely right. We have to deal with those B felonies. And we can do better. And every year that we go back, we will do better.
So how many votes did the Working Families Party get on its line in November?
Well, I think it's that we got 155,000 votes statewide when people voted for pulled the lever, you know, for Chuck Schumer. We got, I think for David Soares up in Albany County, you know, we won that by 63%, so I don't know the exact numbers. We've gotten up to 200,000 votes from a little party that started 6 years ago that barely made 51,000 votes. So there's been, you know, we've run about 400 candidates for a lot of different offices. If you were to just add them all up, it would be millions of votes. But I think the highest number that we've gotten so far, statewide, for statewide office, is about 155,000 votes.
But when elections can be lost, won or lost by 500 votes, that's nothing to sneeze at.
Or by 5 votes. Yeah. And here's the beauty of that. People vote on our line because they're voting our values and because we're a 365-day-a-year party. You know, we had to work 365 days a year to raise the minimum wage. We don't have 155,000 registered voters. But when folks go into that voting booth, they trust the party, and they vote for people on our line. And we think that that's super, and that's how democracy should work.
We've only got like a minute left, but what's next on the agenda?
Well, I think what's next is health care. What's next is continuing on Rockefeller Drug. What's next is some major revamping of housing policy and law, and setting ourselves up for 06 and 08.
All right, well, that's you got a lot on your plate then. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for all the work you've been doing, and congratulations on these victories. I've been speaking with Bertha Lewis, co-chair of the Working Families Party in New York State, and we'll be back in a moment to speak with Jamie Galbraith.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
And this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're about halfway through. And let's take a little musical break. Listen to this from, who is this? This is Chicks on Speed, and we'll be back with Jamie Galbraith.
Hi, my name is Julie. I like Mac Power Books and electronic music.
Wanna be the ruler of the galaxy.
Wanna be the king of the universe.
Let's meet and have a baby. Wanna be the Empress of Fashion.
Wanna be the President of Moscow.
Let's meet and have a baby.
Chicks on Speed, an excerpt from their song, Song for a Future Generation. And we're now back and joined on the line by Jamie Galbraith, who teaches economics at the University of Texas in Austin. And the dollar, of course, very much in the news lately, the weakness of the dollar against foreign currencies, particularly the euro. And relevant to that, the U.S. Treasury held an auction of its 10-year bonds earlier today, and it was characterized by the fact that foreign buyers really stayed away in droves, as Samuel Goldwyn put it. Foreign buyers, particularly foreign central banks, Chinese, Japanese central banks, have been buying up our treasury paper, enabling the United States to run large trade deficits and enabling us to run up the visa bill and have a Merry Christmas and all those kinds of things. There are some signs that inflow is slowing to a trickle, hasn't yet turned into an exit yet, but that's always a risk. And also the U.S. dollar has been very weak in foreign exchange markets. And so ask Jamie Galbraith, who has a piece recently put up on TomPaine.com. On these and related issues, so I asked him to talk about that. Welcome to WBAI, Jamie.
Thank you.
So why should the average listener who doesn't have a large portfolio of treasury bonds or anything remotely resembling that, why should they care about what's going on with the dollar?
Well, that's a good question. I think they perhaps should care less about it than they're being told to, because they can't escape from the dollar in any event. So Americans are basically spectators at what is a global poker game. With remarkably few major players, the U.S., the European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, the Bank of China, and what those players decide to do, or I think more likely decide not to do, will determine the fate of the dollar for the immediate future.
Most other countries, the exchange rate is extremely important, because most other countries don't import and export in their own currency. They have to worry about the exchange value of their currency. If their currency goes down in value, the price of oil goes up and the price of many other things goes up. We're insulated from that. So does it really matter to us?
It matters a great deal less to us, and we have an enormous advantage in the world economy from the fact that we provide the reserve currency to the world. And that's the situation that's going to cause the major players, the Japanese and the Chinese in particular, to be very careful about what they do. Because if they were to panic, the financial losses would fall in the first instance on themselves. It's like Bill Gates cannot sell Microsoft and expect to walk away with his portfolio intact. The Japanese are in somewhat the same situation with respect to us.
Yeah, so if word started spreading that the Japanese were lightening up on their dollar holdings, then everyone would panic, right?
Well, the price would fall, and the losses would be felt first and foremost by the guys with the largest holdings, who would still be the Japanese. So their interest is in stability. And my instinct, I could be wrong about this, of course, and there could be a panic, but my instinct is that there may well not be, because the largest players have a strong incentive to play very cautious hands.
But it's not just what they do with their existing holdings. They have to keep buying the stuff to keep us running large trade deficits. We have to borrow enormous amounts abroad every day. And if we don't get that inflow, we've got a problem. So we're going to keep buying.
Yes, but their interest is in selling to us. And that's a more compelling interest than the reservations they may have on the financial side. The Chinese economy depends upon having a manufacturing sector that's fueled by sales to the United States. And so the other side of that coin is that somebody has to hold the resulting surplus of dollars. I suspect the Chinese will continue to hold their share, and I suspect they would continue to buy dollars eventually, even if the value fell, because you always have to absorb your losses and look forward rather than backward. And even if they didn't, the major loser from a strongly appreciating euro, the major alternative currency, is the European Union. So it's also quite possible that the Europeans may intervene to hold the dollar up and the euro keep the euro from rising too rapidly.
Well, as Laura Tyson said a while back, Asia lends, America spends. There's a saying on
Wall
Street.
That's very nice. I wish I'd thought of that.
It's a nice little rhyme. There's a saying on Wall Street, though, that trees don't grow to the sky. I mean, is this a limitless process, or is it going to have to come to an end at some point?
All things, I think, come to an end. The half-life of international monetary systems in the past century was perhaps only about 30 years. Regimes have to be changed when debt burdens get too high or when a country ceases to perform the kind of stabilizing role in the world system that it started out performing, and that's what happened to the British Empire. And I suspect that we are running grave dangers because we are no longer providing the kind of confidence-inspiring, stabilizing security role in the world that we did through much of the Cold War. The main worries I would have would be a crisis induced by additional recklessness on the international security front, whether in the Middle East or in some kind of confrontation with China down the road. Those kinds of things could be the precipitating events that would really shatter confidence in the dollar.
Since the bulk of the rise against the dollar has been experienced by the euro, and it's quite possible that this could drive already weak European economies into a recession or something resembling that. Is the Bush administration entirely unhappy with this turn of events? Or they kind of like screwing the Europeans?
Yeah, I don't think the Bush administration is. The fall of the dollar has some benefits for their friends and major costs for entities that they are not particularly sympathetic to, and Europe is certainly very high on that list. But the European problem is inflicted on Europe by European policymakers. It's not that they risk a recession. They are in a long-term depression from the standpoint of mass unemployment. They're experiencing a totally unconscionable rate of unemployment across the European continent. It's largely because their policymakers are simply not responsive to the need to pursue a high employment policy. That's their own fault, and I don't see how U.S. policymakers can be blamed for the state of the European economy.
Well, is it possible that the European central bankers are keeping rates very high and keeping the unemployment rate very high as a result? Is it possible that they're really trying to crack European labor and deregulate their economy so that they have a large low-wage labor force just like we do?
That's part of it. They're in certain policymakers are in a long-term campaign against European social democracy and against the trade unions. And a part of it is simply that you have a class in Europe, and specifically the older and wealthier segment of the German population, which has been accumulating for decades and which now has an enormous creditor position. German household saving is like 6% of GDP, more than investment. And that class has an enormous hold over the imagination of bankers and policymakers. They want a high rate of financial return. What Germany and Europe really need is a way to redistribute those savings and put them to work and put Europeans to work, providing services, among other things, to other Europeans. They simply haven't got the policy process, perhaps not the imagination, to make that happen.
But then the other side of it is in the United States, we have extremely low rate of savings, people borrowing money like crazy to maintain relatively high levels of consumption. This is almost, in many ways, a mirror image of what the European disease is all about.
Well, I'd rather have the consumption and the employment than have the savings and stagnation. And so, I mean, we do have problems. There's no question that you run into issues of sustainability and vulnerability when you play the game the way the U.S. does. But it's just much better if your population can graduate from school and find jobs most of the time. And that's a huge advantage that the U.S. has enjoyed for a long time over the Europeans.
But if the United States were an ordinary country and we're running a current account deficit 5% of GDP, maybe even bigger, running up large net debts abroad, if this were an ordinary country, the IMF would be imposing structural adjustment on us. But, of course, we're not an ordinary country, so how long can this go on before something crunches?
Well, that's a mystery, and I don't think anybody knows. You might say, I mean, one way to visualize the present system is to say that it's an informal Bretton Woods. And Bretton Woods was a system which was dollar-centered and in which the whole world basically benefited from the provision of liquidity through the IMF to the world economy. We don't have the IMF performing that function anymore, but we do have the U.S. providing liquidity to parts of the world economy. Curiously, the major beneficiary is China, which stayed outside of the World Bank IMF system while it existed and outside of the purview of commercial banks during the period when commercial banks were lending like crazy to the developing world. So it's a very ironic trading region which has developed, the U.S., Japan, China, and a handful of other places, with great parts of the world economy left out, Latin America basically in stagnation for two decades, Africa falling off the charts. And that's a big problem. But the system is not unlike the Bretton Woods system in that it depends upon dollars providing liquidity for the countries with whom we trade. And that can go on as long as they're prepared to continue to play the game, to accept the dollars as a financial asset and not to reject it or attempt to reject it in favor of something else.
Now, every now and then you hear, well, there was talk in the markets the last couple of weeks that Russia was moving its reserves out of dollars and into euros. You hear the same about OPEC moving its reserves, some of its reserves into euros. How seriously do you take this, and is it some sign that the world is slowly moving away from a dollar standard?
It is a sign that certainly Russia is moving away from a dollar standard, and it's perfectly reasonable that Russia should do so, since the great body of its exports, particularly energy exports, natural gas and oil, is simply piped to Western Europe, so it's being paid in euro, and for it to then convert the euro into dollars, particularly if the dollar is losing value, does not make a lot of sense. And the same could be said for a good part of the Middle East, which is supplying oil to Europe and Japan. We get our oil primarily from other parts of the world, from South America, from Nigeria. So I'm not surprised by this, but I don't think those players are fundamental in terms of their weight in the world economy and particularly in the world financial system to the future of the dollar. The fact is it's China and Japan which are the really large single players. And so long as they maintain their sang-froid, their keep cool about the situation, the dollar, the system is as likely to muddle through, perhaps likelier to muddle through than it is to collapse.
There certainly is a lot of that heavy breathing collapse talk running around now, though.
I think people should be take that with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Oh yeah, at least one grain, maybe even something larger.
Yeah, I mean, as the dollar goes down, it is true that the American banking institutions will fall in the league tables of world banks, and European ones will rise. And that, but that's an inside baseball game. It's of interest to people in your corner of the world, much less so to the larger population.
I'm speaking with Jamie Galbraith, who teaches at the University of Texas, there's this always possibility that the dollar could decline in an orderly way that would make imports more expensive, exports less expensive, and bring America's accounts closer to balance. And we could have a kind of gentle adjustment stretched out over the course of several years, and everyone will be emerge a little happier when it's all over. Is that a possibility?
I think it's unlikely that we're going to see a correction of the current account on a significant scale. The current account is now 5.5% of GDP. It's a huge structural gap between what we import and what we export. And as the dollar declines, my suspicion is that the Chinese will keep the renminbi pegged to the dollar so that the price of Chinese imports will not particularly rise. What we're likely to see is an adjustment in the oil price, because OPEC will raise the dollar price rather than lower the euro price. And maybe that's already built into the rise in oil prices that we've already seen. But in any event, oil prices are going to be much higher going forward than they have been in the recent past. And that's where I think the adjustment in the living and consumption standards of American households will really fall. People will be paying a lot more for energy relative to what they historically used to do.
Yeah, there are people who talk as if this process of adjustment would be kind of painless and unfelt by anyone, but we're really talking about if we want to bring the current account closer to balance, it would mean some kind of decline in the American standard of living, wouldn't it?
I don't think we want to bring the current account closer to close to balance.
Well, whether
we
want it or not, if it's
going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't think that would imply either an enormous increase in our exports, which would be a good thing, but there is very little institutional mechanism in the world economy to bring that about, or an enormous decrease in our imports, which would be a disaster for the living standard of American households, to say nothing of precipitating a depression-level crisis in Asia, which is supplying our imports to us. So I think we should get away from the idea that it would be a good thing if we were in balance. What we want is to have a situation which is sufficiently stable that it doesn't come unraveled. And I think we can achieve, I think it's at least possible that we'll be able to achieve that much. But we shouldn't be talking about balancing the trade account. That's totally unrealistic. And as it's unrealistic, so is it unrealistic to talk about balancing the budget in the present situation. So long as American households are saving and investing roughly in balance, which happens to be the case right now, the current account deficit is what's going to govern the budget deficit. You're not going to get a reduction of the gap between taxes and spending.
And I want to get to the domestic politics in just a moment, but if Alan Greenspan were a conventional central banker, he doesn't often act like one, even if he talks like one. He would be driving up interest rates in an effort to defend the value of the currency. That is, pushing up interest rates would theoretically attract capital here and push up the value of the currency as a result. Do you think Greenspan's going to do that?
I hope he doesn't. It would be a monumental folly. We did it, of course, in the early 1980s, and, of course, we did defend the dollar, but at the expense of an enormous part of our manufacturing industry and our competitiveness in the world economy, from which, frankly, we still haven't recovered. I think Greenspan recognizes that a similar effort now would be even more cataclysmic because the American household sector is much more deeply indebted now than it was 20 years ago. And so you would essentially have a crisis of housing and home ownership in this country, which would really be a dramatic political and economic event. So it's a situation where even though you might say, well, we might have been better off if we'd run the world economy in such a way that we didn't have these enormous current account deficits and buildup of debt, dollar reserves in the rest of the world over 30 years, there's really not much we can do about it now. And almost anything that we might attempt to do, defending the dollar by raising interest rates dramatically or attempting to fix the current account by cutting the budget deficit, is going to do more harm than good. And I think we're better off with a strategy of let's see how other people might act to adjust and help the system to go forward than trying to accept these scolding prescriptions we're getting from the IMF and the OECD at the moment and doing something that would drastically harm the economy here at home.
And really, is this trade imbalance, the credit account imbalance, something that could easily be fixed by currency movements, or is it a lot of it the results of Walmart sourcing heavily in China? And the movements of currencies are really a secondary consideration to the fact that the average Chinese worker makes 62 cents an hour.
Well, the channels get dredged, and it's hard to change the flow in those channels once that's happened. And the kind of thing you're talking about, outsourcing patterns of procurement and so on, are part of a network of trade, which would be very costly both to us and to the Chinese to disrupt. So one should be very careful about attempting to do that. My own sense is that if you simply let the dollar fall with respect to the euro, as I said before, the Chinese are not likely to let the renminbi rise. And even if they did, they would be slitting their own throats. We would continue to procure imports from other parts of the world where labor remained comparatively cheap. Jobs would not necessarily come right back to the United States. So I'm not a believer in the idea that you can correct a $600 billion current account deficit with a plausible movement of the exchange rate, at least not in any short period of time or at acceptable cost.
And in the piece you have on the TomPaine.com, there's a section called A Strange New World, in which you say, for this reason, we're more likely to enter a strange new world where Republicans in office behave like 70s Democrats on meth. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the 70s, the things were coming apart. We had stagflation, inflation, and slow economic performance, relatively high unemployment, the Democrats, really didn't change their approach to economic policy. And I suspect that the Republicans are going to face this similar situation and face it in a similar way. The reference to on meth means everything's a little bit speeded up. We're going to see rising prices because of the shock to energy costs, perhaps some other commodity costs. We are seeing already, if you look at the news today, a sign that, economic growth continually gets predicted and continually falls short of expectations. And that's because households, among others, are heavily indebted and are more likely to slow their consumption moderately than they are to accelerate it. Businesses still haven't been persuaded that there's a great new horizons for profitable investments. So the overall economic outlook is one that's, I would say, modestly stagflationary, and that's something that the Republicans are probably going to find that they have to defend and justify. I don't think the public's going to be terribly tolerant of that, but that's the situation they're going to be in.
So is it kind of a blessing in disguise that Republicans are going to have to handle all this for the next 4 years?
I wouldn't go that far. They are going to be faced with some very difficult challenges. And one can only hope that they are pragmatic and flexible about it. Republicans sometimes are. The later Reagan administration, in my view, to a large extent, worked to correct the excesses of the earlier Reagan administration and, to pretty good effect. And I think Democrats should be really careful about lining up with, scolding fingers and saying you ought to be balancing the budget or you ought to be defending the dollar, because we should not be in the position of saying that, that we've got a bad situation and the remedy is to take drastic measures that will make it worse. That's something Democrats should be offering, an alternative vision, but it should be one that's strategic, that's focused on the long term, that's growth oriented, that's oriented toward the real future of the country, which is always in the sphere of technological change, the generation of new technologies, attracting capital to our activities, because we are, in fact, defining the future in some sense. That's what we do best when we do it properly. If the Democrats are a party of balanced budgets and higher interest rates, I don't think the voters will be very interested in them, and I don't think they should be.
Yeah, let's hope they don't break out the hair shirts like they did in 84 and 88.
Yeah, I mean, that's of course, exactly what I worry about, yeah.
We have only a minute or so left, but if you were the czar of the economic world, what kinds of policies would you take to cure these rather sickly situation we're in?
Well, I think we've had two decades in which a large part of the world, including a part that we're deeply involved in, Latin America, also Africa, large parts of Asia, have had extremely uneven and in many cases poor, in some cases disastrous economic performance. I would look to creating an environment in which our trading partners in those regions could grow more steadily and more successfully, in which we can supply exports, advanced exports, capital goods, machinery, the things that we do supply to the world economy, that we should be building a stronger U.S. economy by a more successful pattern of cooperation with the outside world. That's how we will improve our current account over the long run. That would be a major part of my strategic vision. On the other side, domestically, I think we need to address our energy dilemma with a strategic program, reduce our dependence on oil, look forward to the day when we'll be needing to have a more balanced energy budget. If we do that, we could do a great deal to promote employment and prosperity here at home. And again, consistent with the kind of international constraints that we face.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
That's a pleasure.
I've been speaking with James Galbraith, who is a professor of economics at the University of Texas and author of a piece put up on Tom Paine recently called Apocalypse Not Yet. You can find that at TomPaine.com. Search for James K. Galbraith's Apocalypse Not Yet. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. A reminder, stop by our book fair here at 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, tomorrow, well, tonight till 9 p.m., tomorrow 3 to 9 p.m., and then over the weekend, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. Remember, you need a picture ID to get into the building because, I don't know, it's a great security hazard of somebody might take hostages of the National Community Development Loan Fund or something. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. We'll have, among other things, Hamid Dabashi, who has been on the show several times, talking about Iran, but he's also a target of harassment by a right-wing Zionist organization, the David Project. We'll talk to him about that, but also about what's going on in Iran these days. A lot of interesting stuff happening there. And until then, so long. Stay tuned for the news. Let's go out with 10cc.